Well, welcome to part five of Versus, and today we're going to talk about peace versus war. I am actually out of town, and yet I said I'm going to pull the video card this week because this message content is such a vital message to the vision of our church. And you'll see why, hopefully, before we're done today. And as a matter of fact, this content is something I'm fully immersed in right now in some of the things I'm doing in training and speaking and leadership. Now, most of us are better at war than we give ourselves credit for. Most of us are pretty good at fighting, right? I like the story of the elderly man who was trying to back his big Lincoln Continental into a parallel parking spot. But before he could get it backed into the spot, a college student in a little Miata, a little sports car, just pulled in right ahead of him. And the college student got out of the car and he said, "Sorry, fella, that's what you can do when you're young and you're quick." And right then, the old man put his Lincoln Continental in reverse, and he started pounding into that little sports car. And this college student started yelling, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" And the old guy said, "Sorry, fella, that's what you can do when you're old and you're rich." Most of us are better at fighting than we give ourselves credit for. We are more sophisticated than that, and we don't back into people's cars, although we would like to. Many of us go to war legally. I'm going to sue you for everything you've got. That's the American way. We can war financially. J. Paul Getty, the millionaire, multimillionaire, changed his will 21 times because of his quarreling with family members. We can war verbally. If you have verbal skills, if you are a master in the art of sarcasm, you can really belittle people, and you can do it in a sophisticated way in front of other people, and you can chew people up and spit them out, and they don't even know that they've been sliced and diced. One of my favorite characters in history is Winston Churchill, and he and Lady Astor had a running feud. And one time, Lady Astor said to Churchill, "Winston, if you were my husband, I would put poison in your tea." And Churchill responded, "Lady Astor, if you were my wife, I would drink it." One time Lady Astor said, "Winston, I believe that you are drunk." And Churchill responded, "Lady Astor, I believe that you're ugly, but I'll be sober in the morning." If you have the ability of sarcasm, you can war verbally. We can war by peer recruitment. Some of us are good at, "I'm going to hurt you by turning other people against you." And so we recruit other people, informing them of how terribly we've been treated. And the idea is if we can get enough people angry toward that person, we have retaliated without actually confronting and having healthy dialogue. We can war by the cold shoulder. We know we're not supposed to fight legally, financially, verbally. So the sophisticated way to fight is to draw back in a shell and to be passive aggressive. We get up and leave. We don't speak. We leave cloaked messages on social media. People don't know exactly who we're talking about, but we're obviously talking about someone in their life. And the idea is, if you hurt me deeply, and now I'm going to hurt you by withdrawing in our relationship. It is childish, but it is a way of letting people know that we disapprove of what they have done. And that's done in marriages a lot. The silent treatment is so common in marriages. If you don't treat me right, I'll punish you by withdrawing my attention and my affection. And we keep going until we think we've punished them enough and made them miserable or made them insecure, made them want to come back to us and grovel. There was a man and his wife who were traveling on a long trip, and they'd had an argument, and they sat in silence for about an hour. And neither one of them spoke. And finally, they rode by a field that was filled with mules. And the husband noticed that the wife was studying those mules, and sarcastically he asked her, "Relatives of yours?" And she quickly responded, "Yes, in-laws." It's amazing how passive-aggressively we are skilled. And there's this give and take, a subtle warring in life. I have been hurt by you. I'm going to hurt you back. And depending upon the level of emotion is depending upon my level of sophistication. I remember years ago reading about a business in Los Angeles that was called Revenge a la Carte. And I remember that for $25, they would deliver, quote, dead flowers or rotten fish to the person you despise or want to put down. And they advertised that they made telling someone to drop dead easy and anonymous. Now, there's something about that that appeals to our nature, right? And let me clarify here, conflict and quarreling. Conflict is inevitable. It doesn't matter what relationship it is, best of friends, best of spouses, there is going to be conflict. Quarreling is optional. Conflict is natural. It's going to happen. But quarreling happens when conflict isn't dealt with maturely and selflessly. As a matter of fact, the New Testament, our Christian scriptures, delineate between what we would call peacemakers. Jesus said this in Matthew 5:9, talked about peacemakers, and war makers. And I want you to walk through this delineation in the letter that Jesus' brother James wrote, and just the differences between a war maker and a peacemaker. Number one, war makers have a hidden agenda. James 4:1 in the Message Bible reads, "Where do you think all these appalling wars and quarrels come from? Do you think they just happen? Think again. They come about because you want your own way and you fight for it deep inside yourselves. You lust for what you don't have and you're willing to kill to get it." Actually, there have been instances where people who identified as Christians killed someone to get what they wanted. "And you want what isn't yours and will risk violence to get your hands on it." This is really important when we get to the application to remember that when I have a hidden agenda that is sometimes hidden from me, that creates conflict, that creates quarreling, that is the basis for war. They are often hidden from us, our agendas, and we don't understand not only why we need to win fights, but why we like to fight. There are battles within us. James says, number two, war makers want from life what only God can give. James 4:2, you wouldn't think of just asking God for it, would you? Waiting. We did a whole series on this a couple years ago. Every relationship has its basis, asking and trusting. Why not? Because you know you'd be asking for what you have no right to. You're spoiled children, each wanting your own way. James, like Jesus, was pretty direct with his words. And war makers want from life what only God can give. Here's the thing about this. If I'm insecure, slights, inattentiveness, and even the presence of conflict are heightened. And only a relationship with God can give you genuine security on the inside to the extent that slights, conflict, disagreement are not a threat to your identity. Number three, war makers default to our divided world's conflict methods. James 4:4, James says, you're cheating on God. If all you want is your own way, flirting with the world, every chance you get, you end up enemies of God and His way. Now stop there. This is why I felt it was important as the lead catalyzer to do this message, is because this is the one area where followers of Jesus are typically no different from the world. No different from how our world tweets, posts, talks. And if all you want is your own way, flirting with the world every chance you get, you end up enemies of God and His way. And do you suppose God doesn't care? The proverb has it that He's a fiercely jealous lover. And what He gives in love is far better than anything else you'll find. It's common knowledge that God goes against the willful proud, but God gives grace to the willing humble. If you do not become intentional about your dialogue skills, about your confrontational skills, about your conflict management style, you will digress to your family of origin's way of dealing with conflict. That may have been good, but my experience is that most people did not grow up in homes that were just ideals of conflict management. And you will digress to the people around you. You'll start tweeting like everybody else tweets. You'll start rebuking people in public the way that the world does it. And that's what it means to be a friend of the world, is you're no different. And what my experience teaches me is that those digressions that we have where we don't reconcile, we don't resolve conflict in a healthy way, are the same as the world. Now look what he does. Earlier in James chapter 3, James says, here's what peacemakers are embodied by. Peacemakers have a humble approach to relationships. James 3:13. Do you want to be counted wise to build a reputation for wisdom? Here's what you do. Live well, live wisely, live humbly. It's the way you live, not the way you talk, that counts. Mean-spirited ambition isn't wisdom. Boasting that you're wise isn't wisdom. Twisting the truth to make yourself sound wise isn't wisdom. It's the furthest thing from wisdom. It's animal cunning, devilish conniving. Whenever you're trying to look better than others or get the better of others, things fall apart and everyone ends up at each other's throat. Humility cannot be faked. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. Humility is thinking of yourself less. Humility comes as a byproduct of God-given security. It is the person who has a security in God who doesn't need to win, doesn't need to punish, and doesn't need to withdraw because their identity is secure. Number two, peacemakers have an authentic God connection that allows peace to flow. James 3:17, real wisdom, God's wisdom, begins with a holy life and is characterized by getting along with others. In the New International Version, it says that wisdom that comes from above is peacemaking. It is gentle and reasonable, overflowing with mercy and blessings, not hot one day and cold the next, not two-faced. You see, you cannot give what you don't have. And if you do not have inner peace, you're going to create outer turmoil. There's that old axiom, if you know peace, K-N-O-W, you will know peace, right? But if there's no peace, N-O, no peace, there's no peace on the outside either. And James says, he says, listen, the wisdom of God that brings peace from above is from heaven alone, is from God alone. We have to live around here. We talk a lot about the shalom. It's translated in English, peace, the peace of God that transcends all understanding. Number three, peacemakers work at healthy relational harmony. James 3:18. You can develop a healthy, robust community that lives right with God and enjoys its results only if you do the hard work of getting along with each other, treating each other with dignity and honor. Relationships, here's the thing most people don't realize. Relationships require skill. Developing specifically conversational skills. There is an art to productive dialogue. And it requires work. It requires hard work. That's why you can tell someone who's not good at all at conflict, they just don't value relationships, so they don't work at it. And that's okay if you're not a follower of Christ, but if you're a follower of Christ, it's not negotiable. Howard Markman examined couples in the throes of heated conversations, and he learned people fall into three categories. Number one, those who digress into threats and name-calling. Number two, those who revert to silent fuming. And number three, those who speak openly, honestly, and effectively. Markman and his associates are able to predict with nearly 90% accuracy the divorces that will occur just based on those three parameters. And they found that the crucial ingredient of those who do not end up in divorce court is crucial conversation skills, effective dialogue skills. You do not have to choose in your relationship, specifically marriage, between being honest and being effective. Silence kills, silence fails, and people who are effective and influential are good at crucial conversations. So one of the things that I've been working on lately is this idea, what goes into crucial conversations? And one of the ways to start is to think about, if you're having a difficult conversation with someone you care about, or even someone you don't care about, think of it as if there is a pool in between the two of you. And Joe Grinney calls that the pool of shared meaning. And as we approach this conversation, we are going to allow for both of us to make a contribution to the pool of shared meaning. Our opinions, our viewpoints differ. But people who are skilled at dialogue allow others to bring their perspective, their opinions, and put them into that pool. And Joe Grinney says this. He says, the pool of shared meaning in business, in academics, in athletics, in family, in small group, the pool of shared meaning is the birthplace of synergy. The word synergy is from a Greek word that means energy together. It's a dynamic relationship. And so when you say, okay, we've got this pool between us and we're both going to contribute to that, you increase information and you increase ownership. This requires listening skills. But people who are skilled at conversation do their best to make sure all ideas and opinions are brought into the open. And again, I cannot emphasize enough, if you have a hard time doing this, you have to grow in security. Because you have to be willing to listen when someone criticizes you, evaluates you. So here are the three steps. I've tried to summarize them. Three steps to crucial dialogue, crucial conversations, effective conflict resolution. Number one, start with your heart. Number two, restrain your brain. And number three, cool the fool. And let's go through those. Number one, the first question to ask yourself anytime you have a heated conversation is, where is my heart in this matter? Is my heart right? James says in no uncertain terms that the basis for quarreling is our hearts are not right. And if your heart isn't right and that agenda is hidden even from you, you will digress into manipulation, debate, withdrawal, and destructive divisive patterns. Joe Grinney talks about two girls who were at Disney with their father. And they were there all day. It was a hot day at Disney World. And they came back to the hotel. And both of them needed to go to the bathroom. There was only one bathroom in the hotel room. And as you can imagine, they started quarreling. I was first. I need to go worse than you do. You're so selfish. And they just started bickering back and forth. Finally, the dad said, listen, here's what you're going to do. Both of you are going to go into the bathroom. And there's going to be one rule. You're not allowed to hit each other. And you're going to work this out. And Joe Grinney says, it must have been his daughters because he had a lot of detail in this story. He said they went in there and 25 minutes later, he heard the toilet flush. 25 minutes later, first girl came out. A few seconds later, he heard the toilet flush again. Second girl came out. And Joe Grinney says, the dad said, girls, I didn't solve that for you, but do you realize that you could have both used the bathroom a long time ago if you would have just worked this out before you went into the bathroom together? And why did it take so long for the two of you to use the restroom? And all of a sudden, the one starts saying, because she's so selfish. Because, oh, listen to her. She's calling me names when she should have just waited. She always has to have her way. Now, both girls claimed that their intention in the dialogue was to go to the bathroom. But they lost that. They lost the point. What their hearts wanted was what their bodies were crying out for, to go to the bathroom. But they lost that. In the skirmish, in the battle, they then behaved in ways that ensured the bathroom was not going to happen quickly. They both lost what they wanted. Look at these words on the screen. Joe Grinney says, that's the first problem we face in our crucial conversations. Our problem is not that our behavior degenerates, it's that our motives do, a fact we usually admit. And the first step in healthy dialogue is to stop believing that other people are your problem. And the people who are best at dialogue believe that the best way to work on us is to start with my heart, to start with me. I'm rarely innocent. I rarely have all the perspective. I have to work on myself first, and that's good because the one person in the conversation that I can change is me. And I can start there. Start with your heart. What are your motives? What do you want? What's the goal here? And let's stick to that. Now that leads into number two. Restrain your brain. Because when we're under attack, our brains fail us. When we feel attacked, we'll resort to fight or flight. And Randy Creamer talks about this so well in his classes. And we resort to stopping any additions to the pool of meaning. And we start looking for ways to win, to punish, or to keep the peace. When we try to win, we are attacking the facts. No, those shoes were not $140. They were $120. You're wrong. And we change our goal from correcting mistakes to winning. We resort to punishing. We want to harm. I'll teach that moron never to attack me again and bring up criticism. Or we resort to keeping the peace. We choose personal safety over dialogue. And rather than add to the pool of meaning and make some waves, very possibly we go to silence. That was my family of origin's way of dealing with conflict. We would just leave the room and we wouldn't deal with it. And our discomfort with the immediate conflict makes us susceptible to the uncertainty of our relationship. And usually bad results come about because we didn't want to have an uncomfortable conversation. People who are good at conflict that has emotion charging the conversation, they have to constantly restrain and refocus their brain. Listen to me. Restrain and refocus your brain during the dialogue. You remember back years ago when Office Depot had that's easy button and you'd push the button and say that was easy. It would all do us well to have a button that has a pause sign on it and we would hit that and pause our brains. Let's say that you're speaking with someone who completely disagrees with you on a hot issue, and as you begin the discussion, start by examining your motives, start with your heart, ask yourself what you really want. And then as the conversation unfolds and you find yourself stating to say, I'm going to defer to the boss, or I'm going to give my spouse the cold shoulder. Pay attention to your objectives. Pay attention to your motives. As you are starting to change your goal to save face, to avoid embarrassment, to win, to be right, or to punish others, stop and refocus your brain on what really needs to happen in this relationship. And here's the tricky part. Our motives in conversation usually change, and we don't even realize they changed. We switched from wanting to go to the bathroom to, I just need to win this conversation. Why does that happen? Well, this is a result of the fight or flight mechanism in our brains. Once we feel under attack, that adrenal mechanism is kicked in, and our brains, the part of our brain that leads to rational decision making, is flooded with adrenal chemicals, and our rational thinking mechanisms start working. Our rational processing just gets washed away with the chemical tide. And in order to move back to motives that are going to allow for dialogue, you have to step away from the interaction and really look at yourself like an outsider. Have an out-of-the-body experience and say, what am I doing? And if I had to guess, what does it tell me about my underlying motive? Has my motive switched? Let's see. I'm pushing hard. I'm making the argument stronger than I actually believe. I'm doing anything to win. I've shifted from selecting a vacation location to trying to win an argument. Learn to stop. This is huge. And recognize what's going on inside of you. Ask yourself these questions. What do I really want for myself? What do I really want from others? What do I really want for the relationship? And how would I behave if I really wanted those results? By asking yourself what you really wanted, it actually affects your physiology. It literally affects your body. Because as you introduce complex and abstract questions to your mind, the problem-solving part of your brain recognizes that, and you're dealing with intricate social issues, and you're not dealing with a tiger that's coming out of the bush to attack you anymore. And so you can be rational. You don't have to run, and you don't have to fight. You can stay engaged. And that leads to the third part. Start with your heart. Restrain your brain. Learn to hit the pause button and say, okay, what's going on inside? And here, and listen closely on this one. Cool the fool. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, Patterson and Grenny talk about the fact in their book, Crucial Conversations, he calls the fool's choice making the conversation a win-lose, either-or, and not an and conversation. Let me explain this. Either-or choices are like this. The only way I can get what I want is to just destroy her argument. I either put up with this selfishness of his or I end the relationship. And look at these words on the screen. Under the influence of adrenaline, we start to simplify the argument. Now, why is this critical? We start to see our options as unnecessarily limited. Under the impact of adrenaline, we start to choose, we think we have to choose between getting the results that we want and keeping the relationship. It's either or. And in our dumbed down condition, because that's what adrenaline does, it dumbs you down to either I need to fight the bear or I need to outrun the guy that I'm camping with so that the bear gets him. And in that level of processing, we don't achieve the option. We don't consider the option of achieving both. And that's why those who are skilled at crucial conversations do this. Here's what they do. This is the critical question. What do I want for myself, for the other person, and the relationship? What do I want? Now, one of the things you'll notice is if you do this, your brain at first will resist this question. Because remember, your brain wants to go to simplicity. Just get it over with. Our brains are lazy and they don't want to work. They don't want to go complex, especially when they're flooded with adrenaline. They just want to fight or flee. And why? It's because that's how we're made to survive attack, right? But we embrace the ease of simply choosing between attacking or hiding, between fight or flight. And when that crucial juncture is where we begin to bring healthy options into the dialogue. I'm sorry, but I just had to destroy her if I was going to keep my integrity. I know it wasn't pretty, but it was the right thing to do. That just destroys. As opposed to that fool's choice, either or win-lose, as opposed to, you know what, I felt like I needed to keep my integrity, but I value her and I value the relationship. And so I listened. I said, tell me more. Help me to understand what you're putting into the pool of meaning. And here's the thing, the fool's choice wants simplicity, but when you force your mind, be transformed by the renewing of your mind, Romans 12:1. When you force your mind to solve the more complex problem of and, what do I want for myself, for him or her, and our relationship, when you start to do that, it does just that. And you have shut down the fool's choice. So here's how this works. Clarify what you want. Say, well, what I want is for my husband to be more reliable. I'm tired of being let down by him when he makes commitments that I depend on. Secondly, clarify what you don't want. What I don't want is to have a useless and heated conversation that creates bad feelings and doesn't lead to change. And then thirdly, present your brain with a more complex problem. How can I have a candid conversation with my husband about being more dependable and avoid creating bad feelings or wasting our time? If you don't intentionally go there, your brain won't go there on its own. Combine the two once and not once in the add and question, and that forces you to search for a more creative and productive options that your brains would have considered. Now you say, you know, that's not possible. You're living in a pipe dream. There's no way with my spouse, with my boss, with my coworkers, with my fellow students, there's no way that's going to happen. Maybe in your family, your office, you can speak honestly and candidly, but if you try it in ours, you're going to get eaten alive. Or you got to know when to fold them, know when to hold them if you're going to survive for another day around here. But the truth is, you'll never know until you try. Start with your heart. Where's my heart in this? Restrain your brain and cool the fool. It is possible. And the only person you can control, you can't control the outcome. You can't reconcile with everyone. You can't. Some people are irreconcilable. But you can control your part. And this is your part. Now, do you remember last fall when we looked at these words, Matthew 5:9, blessed, rich, and peace are the peace manufacturers. For they will be called the children of God. In other words, the world will look at people who are good at reconciliation. They'll say, You look like your Heavenly Father. If we don't reconcile, if we just move on from conflict and we eliminate those people from our lives, if we win and we punish, we're no different from a nasty tweeting world, from a world of road rage, from a world of divorce court. And Jesus is the Prince of Peace. He is the cosmic reconciler. In one section in 2 Corinthians, Paul said, now that we have been reconciled to God, we now have a ministry of reconciliation. Our whole lives are all about the art of trying to work out conflict, to reconcile quarreling and bring about grace and healing. And it can happen. And Jesus says, blessed are those of you who cooperate with a spirit of reconciliation that has been put into your heart, who muster the courage and character to go to someone you're skirmishing with and say, as far as I'm concerned, enough. Let's reconcile this. One of my dearest friends, years ago, we had a severe disagreement. And in years past, both of us admitted, years past, we would have moved on. We just said, I don't have time for this. But we didn't do that. And it changed my life because it taught me to forgive. It taught me that relationships are worth starting with my heart. What are my motives? Restraining my brain and cooling the fool inside of me that wants to simplify things to either or instead of and. And Jesus said, you're going to be blessed. You're going to live life if you have an inner security from me, because my kingdom from above has come, the kingdom that brings peacemakers, that brings wisdom. Some of you remember the story of Corrie Ten Boom. Corrie Ten Boom spent time with her sister Betsy in Ravensbrück concentration camp during World War II. And Ravensbrück was the site of the Lilac Girls, the girls who were severely deformed so that the Germans could practice medical applications on them. It was awful. She was humiliated, and her sister, her dear sister Betsy, died there. Her story is told in the book, The Hiding Place. And after she was released at the end of the war, she spoke about God's grace at a meeting at a church in Munich, Germany. And a prison guard she recognized from that same camp was there and heard her speak about God's grace to forgive. And after the service, this guard at Ravensbrück came up to her and wanted to shake her hand. She wrote, he said, a fine message, Fräulein. How good is it to know that, as you said, all of our sins are at the bottom of the sea and God remembers them no more. And she said, I, who had spoken so glibly of forgiveness, fumbled in my pocketbook rather than take his hand. He would not remember me, of course. How could he remember one prisoner among those thousands of women? But I remembered him. I remember the leather whip swinging from his belt. It was the first time since my release that I had been face to face with one of my captors, and my blood seemed to freeze. You mentioned Ravensbrück in your talk. He said, I was a guard there. No, he did not remember me. But since that time, he went on, I have become a Christian, and I believe that God has forgiven me for the cruel things I did there. I have repented. But I would like to hear it from your lips as well, Fräulein. And again, his hand came out. Will you forgive me? He asked. And Corrie Ten Boom said, I stood there. I, whose sins had every day been forgiven and cleansed, and I could not. Betsy had died in that place. Could he erase the slow, terrible death simply for the asking? It could not have been many seconds. He stood there, a hand held out, but to me it seemed like hours as I wrestled with the most difficult thing I ever had to do. For I had to do it, and I knew that. The message that God forgives has a prior condition that we forgive those who have injured us. I knew that not only as a commandment of God, but as a daily experience. Since the end of the war, I had had a home in Holland for the victims of Nazi brutality. And those who were able to forgive their outside enemies were also able to return to the outside world and rebuild their lives, no matter what the physical scars. But those who had nursed their bitterness became invalids. It was as simple and as horrible as that. So I stood there with a coldness clutching my heart. But forgiveness is not an emotion. I knew that too. Forgiveness is an act of the will. And the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. And I prayed silently, Jesus, help me. I can lift my hand. I can do that much. But you have to change my heart. You have to supply the feeling. And so woodenly, mechanically, I thrust my hand into the one stretched out to me. And as I did, an incredible thing took place. The current started in my shoulder and raced down my arm, sprang into our joined hands. And then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing tears to my eyes. I forgive you, brother. I cried with all my heart. And for a long moment, we grasped each other's hands, the former guard and the former prisoner. I had never known God's love.